welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Josh Borger, sitting in for your host, Jeff Hayden. We've been living under a pandemic for quite some time. We've had restrictions from the government that have been placed on our businesses and our personal liberties. We're not used to these type of restrictions given the liberties granted to us in the Bill of Rights. So tonight we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the restrictions that are placed on us and whether those are in fact valid and lawful under the liberties granted to us under the Bill of Rights. Our guests tonight are Shilpi Agarwal, who is the Legal Policy Co-Director of Litigation at the ACLU of Northern California. In this capacity, she works on a range of issues, including criminal justice, Fourth Amendment privacy, abolition of the death penalty, free speech, and voting rights. Prior to joining the ACLU, Shilpi was an assistant federal public defender in San Francisco, where she defended indigent people accused of federal crimes. In that role, she regularly briefed and argued issues affecting criminal defendants in federal court, served as lead counsel in multiple federal trials, and argued before the Ninth Circuit. Our second guest is Professor Margaret Russell. She's been a member of the Santa Clara University School of Law faculty since 1990 and is affiliated with the University Center for Social Justice and Public Service, the Markula Center for Applied Ethics, and the Center for Multicultural Learning. She's been honored for her contributions to student life at Santa Clara by the Asian Pacific Law Students Association and the Black Law Students Association. In 1991, she traveled to South Africa with a delegation of legal scholars to provide consultation on constitution drafting for the post-apartheid transition. Professor Russell, Shilpi Agarwal, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We have a lot to talk about, and we can take this in a number of directions, but why don't we first start with the stay-at-home orders? There were a lot of people who were not allowed to go to work, to go elsewhere that they were accustomed to going to earn a living potentially. And there were questions of whether this would constitute a takings under the Constitution, whether they were deprived of their property without due process. Could someone take us through an analysis, or what, if anything, the courts have decided on this to the extent they have?
Well, let me start off by actually mentioning that the stay-at-home orders, as well as the mask orders seem to have caused quite a bit of consternation and protest. And basically the way that the constitutional framework works here is that, let's say you do have a fundamental right here, and as you mentioned, a taking of property without due process, or as many people have argued, taking of liberty actually without due process of law. So liberty interests, takings involve what are called fundamental rights, as lawyers usually learn in first year of law school. And fundamental rights of the individual can be abridged under very narrow circumstances. And those narrow circumstances require what's called a compelling governmental interest and a narrowly tailored means, or most narrowly tailored means. And what that means in this context is that governments, and so far it's state or local or county, not federal, have maintained that they have to issue such orders because there's a compelling interest in public health during the pandemic. Courts generally would find that to be compelling, and the contention would be about how specific or constrictive that orders could be. And I take it maybe from Shilpi that that's what some of the lawsuits are about. And so they would have to do with how long in time the orders last, how restrictive of personal movement and freedom they are, whether or not they are enforced in a discriminatory manner.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the interesting thing about the current context with the pandemic is that the stay-at-home orders have been evolving. They have not been static orders that have sort of stayed the same over the course of the pandemic. And I think that is a really critical fact, because the initial orders that came down here in California, we were some of the first to be subject to stay-at-home orders, and then they started to spread across the country. They were incredibly restrictive. I mean, they basically shut everything down because it was clear that the government just didn't know what it was dealing with, you know, didn't know sort of a lot about the virus, how it spread, what were the actions that could be taken to mitigate the spread of the virus, what were the real health ramifications of it. And so they sort of had to go to the most restrictive action that they possibly could. But I think the critical fact from sort of a takings and due process kind of analysis is that the orders themselves have been evolving, and people's rights have slowly, and people's ability to sort of engage in the kinds of activities they're used to have been coming back as governments have been learning more about the virus, how it spreads, what are the things we can do? What are the things that we can do to mitigate the spread, even assuming that folks are going to work and engaging in the things that they usually engage in? And I think that is really the critical aspect of why I think the litigation has been, you know, not successful. There haven't been a lot of really successful challenges to these orders. And I think it's because no government has claimed that the sort of ultimate restriction is permanent, nor have any of those restrictions sort of stayed the same throughout the length of this pandemic. They've been evolving.
Well, let's move on to a slightly different, but the analysis might be the same. In the beginning, and maybe even now, there were problems where people couldn't gather for religious reasons. There were too many people in a room. And then it became the Constitution, of course, grabs freedom of religion. How did the courts, to the extent they did, chime in on that? Can the government, due to the pandemic, prevent large gatherings for religious reasons without violating the First Amendment?
Well, so another part of the First Amendment, as you're pointing out, is not just freedom of speech or freedom of association, but these two clauses having to do with religion. And very early on, it became clear that the bans on assemblies of more than a certain number of people in a certain space were being enforced for public health reasons. If a government entity said, you know, we are banning religious gatherings, then that would definitely be unconstitutional because they would be singling out a particular subset of groups. But if they have a neutral ban or regulation of assembly and it affects a religious institution, then those are generally upheld. And as you know, there were many stories in the news about, you know, pastors, about ministers who really fought closing their churches because to them and their congregations, it was important and necessary for the exercise of their religion to be in the church or be in the religious building. And so that was a real tussle and a tension. But, you know, the strength of the pandemic and required the government to come forward with really proof that having more than a certain number of people in that institution would be dangerous. So there was more spreading out and distancing and even open air. I mean, I went to a parking lot church ceremony, which is still an outside parking lot religious ceremony.
Yeah, the church question was an interesting one. I mean, Pentecostal Church was the Supreme Court decision that came down in the midst of this pandemic, in which California's restrictions on church gatherings was actually challenged, made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and somewhat surprisingly, the Supreme Court actually upheld the restrictions that California had put in place on church gatherings. And I think the critical issue, as Professor Russell pointed out, is really, are you treating religious gatherings different from other kinds of gatherings? And what Roberts, who supplied the fifth vote in that case, really found was that religious gatherings were being treated in the same way as other sort of large gatherings in which people were all congregating under one building, and that they all had the same restrictions imposed on them. This wasn't singling out religion for any one particular purpose, for any reason. And that the kinds of businesses that had been allowed and that weren't subject to the same restrictions didn't have the same conditions of like lots of people packed into one building. Something that we really focused on at the ACLU was sort of the inverse of that, which is if you're going to let religious gatherings happen under a certain set of conditions, you've also got to start letting people go out to protests, for example, or exercise their First Amendment rights in other ways subject to the same conditions. Meaning, if you government have deemed it safe to have 25 people in a building to pray, you've also got to allow 25 people to congregate to protest something the government is doing, or 25 people to stand outside of a detention facility and protesting ICE detention. And so something that was really on our radar was that as government started actually opening up a little bit, and there was this pressure around allowing religious gatherings to take place, just as, you know, if the public health situation didn't allow for certain gatherings to take place in the religious context, they should also allow sort of freedom of assembly to take place in other contexts as well. And it was interesting, different counties had different approaches to that. In some counties started allowing, for example, vehicular church service to take place, but they were still citing folks for participating in car protests. And that was something that we really had a problem with. And so I think the critical fact is really like the justification around assembly is the public health context. If you're allowing assembly in one context, you've got to sort of make sure that you're doing it in the other so that there's no kind of content discrimination of any kind. But it was interesting. I mean, the whole situation was actually quite interesting because, you know, something that we were really, the way that the analysis, and I'm sure Professor Russell, you can speak to this more than I could, but, you know, the way First Amendment analysis actually works in this context is when you're evaluating government action, you have to look at whether it's, for time, place, and manner restrictions, you have to look at whether it's content neutral, you have to look at whether there is an alternate means of sort of effectuating the same communication. And something that we at the ACLU were really sort of conscientious about was we were worried that like the pandemic was going to be used as a way for the government to make this argument that like electronic channels of communication were an adequate alternate means of exercising our right to assembly. So like, you can't get out and protest with people that share your beliefs, but you can join a Facebook group and you can really like voice your belief. And we were that was very much on our radar because, you know, the freedom to assemble and protest really is like so built into the fabric of our society. And there is something about the sort of physical part of getting together and sort of, you know, appearing in these large groups and marching down the street. It's a very powerful thing, as we saw from the summer in George Floyd. And one thing that our antenna was really up on, during all of these shelter in place orders was there going to be a case or something that came down where a court or the government made the argument that no, these shelter in place orders are okay because one of the alternate means of communication that we have is electronic assembly effectively. And, you know, anything other than like kind of a massive global pandemic and, you know, people would be in the courts challenging something like this, you know, until we're blue in the face. And, you know, this was a very unique circumstance, but we were really worried about what case law could potentially be generated that could then extend to a non-pandemic circumstance about the government's ability to limit our freedom to assemble. You know, that was something that was very worrisome to us.
You know, that's so interesting to think of in terms of the history of freedom of assembly to petition the government for redress of grievances, because I think you're right. That so much brings to mind physical presence, you know, going out in the streets. And actually over the last, you know, decade or two of teaching constitutional law, I have wondered if new generations were sort of growing up without a sense of putting your body out there, just being online and thinking that that was the same. And I'm actually delighted and relieved from this summer's protest that there are many people, including young people, who still construe it as physical presence with other people in order to effectuate change.
Yeah, there's something about that energy that I think you really can't replicate in an online situation. You know, the energy that comes from being out in a protest, I think that you just can't replicate. And, you know, there were, I think, one of the unfortunate sort of byproducts of this period of time early in the pandemic when people could not take to the streets were there was a lot of suffering happening. You know, we did a lot of work around what was happening in the jails and immigration detention facilities, and there were lots of instances in which folks wanted to go out there and protest how some of what the government was doing was having a disproportionate impact on particularly vulnerable communities. And the inability to sort of get out and protest, I think, was a real, I think it was a real detriment to people's ability to engage with the public health decisions that were being made. I mean, right or wrong, we can agree with them, which I think, I think most people would agree the pandemic has been such a unique situation that it justified a lot that would otherwise be unjustifiable. But still, I think people's level of ability to engage with it was somewhat curtailed by just the inability to actually gather and sort of and demonstrate in a traditional way. So I think that the pandemic has taught us how important that is, I think.
Absolutely.
So if anyone has any questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You both have said, and we know this, that this is a once in 100 years, once in a lifetime scenario. This is very much the oddity. And of course, everyone is hearing a lot about the flu epidemic from the early 20th century. Are there cases from that time dealing with analogous situations that courts are citing to that are enlightening us at all?
You know, one case that is cited very often because it's so rare in Supreme Court jurisprudence doesn't have to do with the pandemic of 1918, but it's a 1905 case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. At a time when there was a smallpox, widespread smallpox. And so the vaccination was made mandatory. A pastor in that case objected to it and argued in part that it was his religious reasons, but also that it actually invaded his body to get a mandatory vaccination. And the Massachusetts law required him without any exception for religion to do that. And he lost, and the Supreme Court did uphold the Massachusetts law, but it framed it carefully in saying that the liberty interest is paramount, but there are extraordinary times with extraordinary measures, they said, and under these circumstances, there can be restraints, and they're enforced by reasonable regulations as the safety of the general public may demand, which I think is a framework that applies now.
One of the issues that we're reading about is the pandemic, the epidemic has run wild in prisons. Prisons aren't designed for social distancing. So does being in jail at this point, which certainly isn't a guarantee, but it's going to give you a higher risk of getting COVID-19, does that in any sense violate the Eighth Amendment? Does that change if you're a pretrial detainee? What are the rights of prisoners given these current circumstances?
Shelby, have you done some of these cases at the ACLU?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. We've done a ton of this litigation at the ACLU. So our affiliates nationwide have actually filed dozens and dozens of cases with respect to jails and prisons when the pandemic hit, precisely because of the reasons that you just alluded to, Josh. I think there are very real Eighth Amendment concerns for post-conviction detainees who are in prisons, and then a similar set of concerns with respect to pretrial detainees and immigration detainees, although the legal standards are actually different with respect to those populations. Those come from due process rights because they are not post-conviction detainees. But I think that the rationale is the same for all of those populations in terms of why COVID has implicated their constitutional rights. I mean, that when you think about sort of the conditions of folks in detention in this country, it's sort of like a hotbed breeding ground for this virus. People are in very close proximity to one another, often multiple people sharing one cell, you know, literally living kind of on top of each other. Just unsanitary conditions kind of around the cells generally. And then there are huge concerns with the adequacy of the medical care that they receive if they are ill or if they are inflicted with a serious illness. And so, you know, those things combined, I think under the Eighth Amendment, the constitutional standard with respect to medical conditions in the Eighth Amendment is whether or not the prison is deliberately indifferent to the medical health or the medical condition of the particular detainee. And when you think about detainees that have any sort of specific health condition that might render them especially vulnerable to COVID, that's where the worry really starts to come in, that you literally created conditions that are the worst possible conditions. You have a pandemic. You have no meaningful way to really stop the spread of a pandemic should it hit these prisons and jails. So what should you do? I mean, what is the answer? And I think for us at the ACLU, the argument that we really made was that these folks should be released. We should start thinking about sort of a wide scale release of folks from detention centers, because it's not like a specific condition could really fix the problem with these detention centers. The confinement itself is the condition that is unconstitutional by virtue of the risk that it exposes particularly vulnerable populations to. And, you know, we made that argument in the Eighth Amendment context. We made it with pretrial detainees who get those same rights through substantive due process. And it's even stronger in their favor because they have not been convicted of anything. These are, you know, they are not subject to any punishment by the government. And then with immigration detainees, similarly, their rights are even more robust because that's civil detention. Immigration detention means they're not there because because of some criminal act. They're there by virtue of their immigration status, and it's considered civil confinement, which also has more robust constitutional rights associated with it. So we definitely think that COVID has implicated, folks that are incarcerated and in detention. And I could speak about this on and on, but I'll pause for a second and see if Professor Russell has anything she wants to say. And then, I could speak about this for a long time.
I'd love to hear more. But, you know, as you're talking, it occurs to me that the convergence of COVID and the pandemic with social movements, in this case, you know, the movement and the achievements in the movement against mass incarceration, make possible arguments that would not have applied decades ago, because, you know, the whole movement against mass incarceration really questions the reasons why people are incarcerated, you know, nonviolent offenders, the validity of the length of sentences, and basically the humanity of people in prison. In, you know, previous pandemics, I doubt that the side of the scale recognizing prisoners' rights would be so strong.
I think that's right. And one thing that has been, I mean, to your point, Professor Russell, one thing that has been a little bit disappointing is, as much as these arguments seemed very obvious to us, I will say that the bench has generally not been super receptive to some of the arguments that we're making. You know, that these cases have had, I would say, mixed results, to be frank, around the country. And I think one thing that has not happened as a result of these lawsuits is we have not seen a lot of release of folks, which maybe it shouldn't be surprising. I mean, I travel in a circle of folks who think that mass incarceration is, you know, one of the biggest injustices of our time. Mm-hmm. So to us, it seemed like release should be obvious, but we basically were getting no's across the board, particularly with the post-conviction folks. We did get out of these lawsuits some changes in just general, like, prison conditions and jail conditions, increased testing, promises about the availability of medical care, improvements in sanitary conditions, availability of masks, things sort of at the margins. That being said, we've seen a lot of outbreaks at prisons and jails all across the country still taking place. And you know, those, the vulnerable communities, you know, say what you will about the crimes that they did or didn't commit, that they were convicted of, those were not death sentences. And right. we've essentially sentenced folks to death sentences. And the last thing that I'll sort of say is, now as the pandemic has dragged on for 8 months or so, another thing that we're seeing is that the quote conditions that prisons are putting in place as a way of dealing with the pandemic has now started to drift into the territory of solitary confinement, meaning keeping people in lockdown for long periods of time, not letting them out, which also has Eighth Amendment implications. There's all kinds of case law that predated the pandemic around, you know, what you can do around solitary confinement. What are the requirements around letting people out of their cell, giving them fresh air? And what we're seeing is that if that's the answer that jails have, meaning you have to choose between dying right. of a pandemic, like dying of COVID yeah. or being in solitary confinement, you just got to release people. You can't just make them choose between their criminal rights. Like, that's not how it works. And so that's kind of how the argument has been evolving, as we're now in month eight.
This happened. So if someone has COVID and they need medical care, if they recover, do they just go back, or are they allowed to be
released? Yeah, I mean, they would go, if they recover, they'll go back into, you know, the jail population. You know, there's been an effort to sort of spread folks out, to give people masks, mm-hmm. to try to do things. And I will say, here in California, you know, among, for example, the jails, there has been a really dramatic reduction in population. The Judicial Council did issue a new bail schedule, which essentially means that people can get out of pretrial detention more readily. And so there has been an effort in some of these facilities to really spread folks out, but that's not true of every, you know, of every facility. And you saw San Quentin, where death row is, you know, where a bunch of our California death row inmates are, had this massive outbreak and had several people die after testing positive for COVID. And it took weeks and weeks and weeks before they did anything really to really address the situation. And I mean, that's been the story around the country. And it's a tough argument to make, because I think that folks think of like people who are in prison as like, well, they did something wrong. So like, but you know, that the Constitution still applies to those folks. And so it's been an uphill absolutely. Battle for sure.
Yes.
We're going to have to take a break in a minute, but let me see if I can squeeze a question in first. There have been access restrictions of prisoners to their attorney. Does this implicate any Sixth Amendment rights?
Have you had cases like that? I mean, it certainly would.
Yeah, we did file one. We have seen that happening a little bit around California. And yeah, we did actually file one down in the ACLU has filed a case down in Kern County that addresses exactly that issue. And yeah, I mean, our position is that the restrictions to attorney visits do very much violate the Sixth Amendment. And, you know, I will say, I think that some of what has been going on with respect to the attorney visitation is, this is giving jails and prisons and CDCR a lot of credit, which is not like me to do, but I will just say that, like, I think some of it has been just a matter of them figuring out how to accomplish meaningful attorney visitation in the era of COVID.
But we're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll let you continue.
Got it.
Thanks.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
She'll be back to you if you can continue. Thanks so much.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'll just finish quickly. I was just saying that I think some of the issues with attorney visitation have been about jails and prisons kind of figuring out how to accomplish what would normally happen through, you know, normal physical visitation in the era of COVID, you know, to give them a lot, you know, to maybe put this in like a positive spin on this. But to be honest, like now that we're 8 months into the pandemic, jails and prisons need to have figured this out by now. Like these folks need meaningful access to their attorneys. And there have been issues with access that we've needed to address through litigation. Like I said, we did file a case down in Kern County on this very issue. We were actually granted a TRO on this basis. But jails and prisons need to have figured it out.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I know this is about your legal rights, but I think so much about the way that the issue of stay-at-home orders and masks has been politicized, you know, and so now it's really intertwined in an interesting way, because, I mean, I consider myself to be, you know, an ardent supporter of civil liberties. Chilpe works for the American Civil Liberties Union. Yet when colleagues of mine at the very beginning were, and these are law colleagues, who they were just so resistant, a couple of them, and very resentful of having restrictions placed. And civil libertarian Professor Russell was just sitting there thinking, are you crazy? You need to wear a mask and you need to stay home. So it's very unfortunate, I think, that the public health need has been construed as kind of political oppression.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree with you. And like you were saying, Professor Russell, at the very beginning, you know, there are certainly constitutional rights. I mean, the entire point of our organization is to sort of enforce those constitutional rights. Yet, I think what very few people sort of are appreciating in some of this discourse is that none of these rights have ever been absolute. Like there are always instances in which the government can kind of infringe upon them if there is a compelling government interest to do so. And I think where maybe, you know, as a civil libertarian, I part ways with all of these folks who are sort of out on the street saying this is a violation of my constitutional rights is like, if ever there was a compelling interest, perhaps a global pandemic that, you know, implicates the lives of hundreds of thousands of people is that interest.
Right.
Well, the interesting next step to that interest is what we've seen is the push and pull between the states and the president about who gets to trigger that interest and when that interest gets trumped, if you will. The president, the current president, of course, was always saying that everything was up to him. Various states, including our own, very much disagree with that. So let's talk about schools, for example, reopening of schools. Who gets to decide? The governor? The president? Whose decision is this? The president has said it was his decision.
Well, traditionally and historically, states have been the decision makers in public education. And it is indeed ironic to find now that, you know, the people who would have argued states' rights or in the past are now saying, as Trump did, you know, I have the power over this. I have the power to send the Federal Guard to Portland. This is a matter of national importance because he occupies the presidency. And I think the politicization has something to do with that, as well as another topic, which I hope we get to later, which is the, you know, the amount of racial discrimination and animus against Chinese citizens and people of Asian ancestry in the country.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think a lot of what Trump has said with respect to the power that the federal government has to make some of these calls is, I mean, it's just as a legal matter, I think it's just wrong, like you were saying, Professor Russell. I think it's just, you know, him playing politics. It's obviously like the plenary power to sort of ensure our public health, protect our public health belongs to the states. They have these like sort of emergency powers to enact all kinds of measures. We have one in California. The ironic thing is yet there is a role for the federal government to play, and they just have not been playing it. And that role is very much in the vein of, you know, making sure there isn't this sort of disparate varying reaction among the states by A, providing guidance from the CDC on like, what should a good shelter in place order look like? What should schools be doing? Making sure that data is collected in a uniform manner and making sure that testing is available in somewhat of a uniform way and making sure that there is uniform provision of medical supplies to all of the states. While the federal government can't sort of dictate or doesn't have dictatorial power to tell the states, like, this is what you have to do, it very much has a leadership role in sort of giving guidance. And Trump is over there saying, like, we have all this power to decide all this stuff. That's wrong. And then the second thing is the stuff that they could be doing and the role that they could be playing in leadership and in helping the states to sort of create a uniform create uniform policies that might allow us to actually fight this thing. They're just not doing any of it. I mean, they're just like sort of sitting there on their hands, claiming that they have all this power that they don't have and not actually doing the stuff that could be helpful.
I do remember in the early weeks in March, and when we were all just so shocked and getting used to it, I would have these habits of my comfort zones of in the morning watching the New York governor give his talk, and then at noon, Governor Newsom would give his talk. And I was thinking, here I am relying upon states' rights as the islands of sanity in terms of public health.
So COVID-19 has led to a lot of forced quarantining. We've talked about that with the stay at home, disease surveillance, and location tracking of those who are infected. Is there any argument to be made, or have people made, that somehow any of this violates the search and seizure provisions of the Fourth Amendment?
Well, you know, to me, the question would be the details of what tracking information is collected and kept, because this is a serious problem in other areas with collection of data. That let's say there's a law or a government program that says, oh, well, you know, we gather this information about, you know, DNA samples or whatever. And then the question is, well, if it is, there's a compelling reason now, but are you going to keep it? For how long? Who has access to the data? What could be the consequences? And I think it's going down that road that really raises Fourth Amendment issues.
So in the temporary,
go ahead.
Forced quarantining right now in the temporary, as you said in the beginning, Professor Russell, that when there's compelling need, and you would claim that is right now, that's going to trump the argument that you can't be forced to quarantine under these circumstances. Fair enough.
Yeah. Shelby, did you have something you wanted to comment on?
Oh, I was going to say, you know, with respect to some of the contact tracing, you know, I totally agree with Professor Russell. I think that the contact tracing seems like an attractive way to sort of approach some of these public health challenges that we're currently facing. I think the real concern is around making sure that there are adequate safeguards around the data. Like, what is the government going to do with the data? How are they going to ensure that it isn't used for any purpose other than the represented purpose? And then secondly, you know, making sure that it is voluntary. You know, like, we're sort of, once we make it voluntary, we actually kind of take you out of the scope of the Fourth Amendment anyway, because it's not a sort of forcible search of any kind. And those two things, I think, are related, because I think if you ensure, if you can promise folks adequate safeguards around a contact tracing technology of some kind, you ensure that people will voluntarily participate in it. And in a public health context, having wide-scale participation in something like contact tracing is necessary to its success. So, you know, from our perspective, any kind of contact tracing technology that the government would use would need to have very strong safeguards around, like, the privacy protections with that information. And it would also need to be, you know, voluntary. It would need to be the kind of thing that people opted into, because otherwise they could just A, I think it would implicate the Fourth Amendment, and B, they could just shut off their phones and leave it at home if you force them to do it. So,
if the government starts subpoenaing cell phone companies to figure out where people are, internet platforms, medical providers in order to get their medical information, all of these things. But let's say they need it because people are not being honest about where they were and who they're with, and it could help in preventing the spread of the pandemic. Do we have a Fourth Amendment problem?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think that, you know, what your question sort of alludes to is this third party doctrine in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, which essentially says if people have given their data to a third party, they sort of lose the quote reasonable expectation of privacy in that data. There's actually now a pretty big exception to that that was just issued by the Supreme Court in Carpenter versus it's the United States, Carpenter. We just refer to it as Carpenter, but Carpenter basically says that that the third party, it limits the application of the third party doctrine to cell site location tracking information. So it says that the government cannot go to cell phone companies and wholesale use a subpoena to wholesale gather large amounts of cell site tracking information from these cell phone companies because that amounts to such a large amount of systematic information that technology makes possible that people don't necessarily expect that they're relinquishing just by virtue of the fact that they're using a cell phone. And so I think that a lot of what you're describing, Josh, would be argued under that sort of Carpenter rubric of, does this fall within the kind of information that folks don't anticipate they are relinquishing to third parties just because they have a cell phone in their hand that traces their movements, which again, I think suggests that it would be much better if people just kept it voluntary.
Mm-hmm. A lot of places when you go to work now, they have some sort of form, a sheet you have to fill out in order to help them trace. A lot of people in various situations are being forced to give information over to trace to make sure you weren't in contact with anyone who had COVID-19. Aren't there privacy implications here?
Well, you know, the first thing I wonder about those forms is, you know, what would happen if you didn't sign it? Or you could easily lie. I mean, there's just no, I'm not sure how useful they are. I remember going into a doctor's office and they said, oh, we have to take your temperature. And they looked at the thermometer and said, 90 degrees. I said, I think that's not a good thermometer. So I do think there are privacy implications. You know, what I find interesting in this sort of like tug, this, you know, push and pull over, you know, COVID denial, COVID awareness, COVID carefulness and caution, is that extreme governmental measures may be amped up the more that people disbelieve that this is a very serious pandemic. And if people don't believe in science and they don't believe that this is a serious pandemic, that in turn gives rise to much more stress on other members of the public and their representatives to say, well, we know that it is, we rely on science, and we're taking measures that are even more stringent than we would have taken when people could, let's say, voluntarily, you know, cooperate.
I totally agree with what Professor Russell says. I mean, I think that, like, there's so many things that we do voluntarily. I mean, private entities, what their requirements are, don't implicate, obviously, the Constitution, because that only regulates the government, but you know, there are lots of privacy statutes out there that could potentially be implicated by what private companies do and what data they collect. That being said, I think all of this becomes less of like a backdrop if people trust the scientists and the doctors who are saying this is what is necessary to control the pandemic. You know, I think is if there's that trust between citizens and, you know, the medical profession and the medical personnel who are saying that this is something that is necessary. You know, a lot of that a lot of those privacy concerns become, you know, take a backseat to what people see as the greater public health crisis. And I think the problem that we are experiencing right now, and even why these questions are coming up around like sort of my right to privacy versus like public health, is because I think there's fundamentally that, you know, that this administration has fueled this doubt about whether this pandemic is actually something to worry about and whether we can trust doctors and scientists who are telling us that this is something that we should worry about. And that I think that's why you have all these people saying, I don't want to give you my, you know, any of this information, because I just don't fundamentally trust that it's inures to my benefit in any way.
Right.
And that's a problem.
Margaret, you wanted to talk about particular animus that has come out of this, that the president keeps calling it, what, the China virus. He keeps referring to that, that it came from the Far East. And as a result, we have seen an increase in hatred in actions taken against Asian Americans.
Yeah, I mean, it's very concerning. And at the beginning, I noticed especially many cases of, you know, hate speech against Asian Americans and, you know, even hate crimes. The reference to this is the China virus, or what did he say, the Kung flu. You know, it really plays into an old, let's say, an old history of government restrictions on people of color, and particularly Japanese American internment. It is also the case that at the turn of the century, the San Francisco actually enacted some laws that particularly had to do with Chinese residents of San Francisco, including in 1901 that required people of Chinese ancestry to undergo inoculation against the bubonic plague. And take a certain serum. There were also restrictions on Chinese residents of San Francisco from traveling outside the city and remaining, you know, essentially, you could say, quarantined or interned in a certain area. And that was challenged in court, and a federal court prevented San Francisco from enforcing the order. But, you know, it really resonates, this idea of national emergency, ramped up fear, and in this case, it's a, you know, an epidemic rather than a time of war, and then the scapegoating of particular racial groups happened then, and it happens now.
And the interesting thing about the racial scapegoating is, I think it started, like Professor Russell said, is like the China, you know, calling it the China virus, and now I think with this data about how the virus itself is sort of disproportionately impacting communities of color. And, you know, here in the Bay Area, you hear about sort of the impact on Latinx communities. I think that that sort of racial animus has seeped into, you know, the way people think about the virus and who's most likely to have it. And I 100% agree that this has taken on so many kind of racial implications, and you know, it's also has triggered certain reactions in people about that are based on race that are truly problematic.
I almost want to take the amendments out of order, if you'll forgive me here. One of the things early on that I was reading with the shutdown was that Americans, some of them at least, like their guns. And people were up in arms, at least some of them, that if you had shelter in place or certain businesses were closed down, that they wouldn't go out and be able to buy their guns. And that was a violation of the Second Amendment. Did any court or rule on this, or do you have any opinions on this? This, it seems no matter what the issue is, the Second Amendment will always rear its ugly head somehow, no matter whether the issue really has anything to do with the Second Amendment or not. We have a pandemic, and people are really more concerned about the Second Amendment.
Well, I don't know of any litigation about you know, guns and the pandemic, but I'm sure a lot of people have noticed that there are stores, there are private entities that have restricted their sale of guns or even eliminated them. And actually, that's not just because of the pandemic. It's because of the incredible strife of white supremacist groups and the tensions leading up to the election, and which may very well still be in effect. Lots of talk about guns. The Supreme Court has held that the Second Amendment does involve a right of private gun ownership. I disagreed with that opinion, but that is the Supreme Court ruling. And so in that sense, the analysis would be if someone were trying to challenge a restriction on their use of guns, not buying guns, but their use and ownership of guns, they would argue that that is a fundamental right. And then there has to be a compelling governmental interest to restrict it.
We have a caller, Roy from San Francisco. Roy, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I wondered if there's any legal right to treatment. For example, remdesivir has been known to be effective against this virus in the early stages since April. It was just FDA approved in October. And for economic reasons or capitalistic reasons, they've kind of suppressed this. And, you know, if I ask for remdesivir, could I get it?
Well, I mean, it would be nice if there were a healthcare right, but the legal right to treatment does not exist in the United States. And in fact, it's dealt with in the policy level and the legislative level. And one of the priorities that's being discussed of a new administration is figuring out an even-handed way of making vaccines and drugs possible, countering COVID, so that the most vulnerable groups to it, people who are lower income and people of color, aren't disadvantaged. You know, so ideally, the availability, it wouldn't be a right, but it would be available in an even-handed way. At least that is the policy goal.
We have maybe 6 minutes left, so I'll tell you what, to both of our guests, why don't you take maybe 3 minutes apiece, and if you could sum up any thoughts you have that we haven't talked about, anything you want our listeners to know about what we've been discussing. Takeaways.
Okay. Who wants to start? Do you want to start?
Sure. I think that the one other thing that I would say that we didn't quite get to was around legal issues and absentee and all male voting, which I know is like front and center of everyone's mm-hmm. minds. I think over the last few months, we have taken all states, voting is largely regulated at the state level, and many states have taken all of these steps to ensure that folks can exercise their right to vote in a safe manner in the era of COVID. And that has involved kind of an expanded use of the quote mail-in or absentee ballot, which are the same thing, even though, certain individuals have suggested they're different. They're the same. Absentee ballot, widespread use of absentee ballots. That has meant, increasing the availability of drop-off locations. It's meant increasing the availability of mail-in ballots. It's also meant making some changes to the way that votes are counted and the time requirements around when they need to be received in some states in order to allow them to be counted. This has resulted in all this controversy. The mail-in and absentee voting has been part of our voting system for ever and ever and ever and ever. And this notion that it is sort of rife with fraud is just absurd and frankly has no actual data to suggest it. In fact, the data suggests exactly the opposite, which is that any instances of fraud have been largely anecdotal and one-off and never impacted an election. And so using this mechanism to allow people to expand to vote safely should only be seen as a good thing. And we should really be embracing this as a great measure by states to try to protect all of our rights to vote, in addition to protecting all of our health. And this idea of attacking absentee ballots as some sort of like fraudulent way of voting is just absurd. And I think, you know, we should pay it no heed.
Are you going to run for the bed, Shelby?
Run for probably I, by virtue of working for the ACLU, I may have disqualified myself.
Right, so. You may have disqualified yourself on that issue. Okay. Professor Russell.
Well, you know, so I've been thinking about climate change, which is not the subject of this show, but I realize this, I think now that this pandemic is not just a once in 100 years, right? I think our society's really shifting into ways in which public emergency will have a very different meaning. I mean, I think in the past we thought of it as, oh, it's 9/11, it's a military emergency. What civil liberties, you know, can we fight to maintain? But increasingly, I really think there are going to be climate and public health emergencies, which is kind of undeveloped. It's certainly undeveloped case law. We have a basic structure, but I think more and more we're going to see climate issues and public health issues related to that as sort of the really bringing into relief the role of government in ways that civil libertarians are uncomfortable with. And we're really going to have to rethink creatively ways to preserve civil liberties and preserve the public good. And I don't have any answers yet, but that's what I've been thinking a lot about.
We actually do have a show coming up in a few weeks dealing with lawsuits related to climate change. So people tune in on that one. That'll be interesting. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been discussing the constitutional the Bill of Rights and the issues dealing with the pandemic. Our guests have been Santa Clara University School of Law Professor Dr. Margaret Russell, who's an Associate Professor of Law affiliated with the University Center for Social Justice and Public Service, the Mercula Center for Applied Ethics, and the Center for Multicultural Learning, courtesy of the ACLU of Northern California. Shelby Agarwal is the Legal Policy Co-Director of Litigation. Next week, and again at our new time of 6 p.m., we'll have a program discussing shareholder activism in a changing corporate environment. Please stay tuned. Once again, Professor Russell and Shelby Agarwal, thank you very much for joining us on Your Legal Rights. At the controls, Debbie Kennedy, and for host Jeff Hayden, I'm Josh Borger. Good night, everyone, and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Once again, 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.